This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Kevin Hart is doing interviews to promote his new film, The Upside, at a time when he's in the news for a totally different reason. After being asked to host the Oscars, he was called out for homophobic jokes from earlier in his career. The Academy asked him to apologize. He insisted he'd already apologized and declined to apologize again, although he since reiterated apologies. He stepped down from hosting, saying he didn't want to be a distraction. Then it briefly looked like maybe he'd host after all, but this past Wednesday, he said that it's definitely not going to happen. He also said he was done talking about it. So where does that leave the interview I recorded with him Wednesday afternoon? Well, we started by talking about the new movie and moved on to talking about what makes a joke funny, as opposed to what just makes the person telling the joke sound clueless and insulting. We also talked about a few chapters of his life. Let's start with a clip from his new film, The Upside. Hart plays someone who's just gotten out of prison on parole. His wife and son are angry with how irresponsible he's been. The terms of parole require that he look for a job. He accidentally stumbles into a job interview as the assistant to a very wealthy man, Philip LaCasse, played by Bryan Cranston, who now has quadriplegia as a result of an accident and needs full-time care. Hart's character, Del Scott, has zero qualifications for this job, but Philip, who barely has the will to live after the accident, kind of likes Del and wants to give him a shot. In many ways, they're totally mismatched. You'll hear one example of that in this clip when Del, Hart's character, walks into Philip's room and finds him listening to opera.
Alexa, stop!
Hey!
What?
I'll get the shower ready.
I want that on.
No, man. Look, I get you trying to block out the world, but can you at least do it to better music?
Have you ever listened to opera?
Yeah, opera's really big in prison. You could hardly get a seat on opera night. Why can't we listen to Aretha? Hmm? You want to feed your soul? Then listen to its queen. Think about it. Yeah. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. It's amazing, ain't it? I sound just like her.
Yeah. When I close my eyes, which I needed to, it's uncanny. It's like identity theft.
Kevin Hart, welcome to Fresh Air. So your occasion for your visit to our show is your new movie, The Upside, so let's start with that. So your character is somebody who has just gotten out of prison. You're out on parole. You've known people like your character in that respect who've gotten out, like your father, I think, did 4 years. And I think your brother was in prison for a time?
My brother did a little bit of time, yes.
So were there things that you could draw on from people you knew, family or outside of family, that you were able to incorporate into the character?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you gotta take from real life, you know. I think the biggest thing that I could take from the character is that this is a guy who wants to change. This is a guy who's been through some really dark times in his life. And getting locked up, being incarcerated, definitely was one of the darkest times. But in him trying to change, he feels like society won't allow him to. He feels like, you know, they say that you want people to be different and learn from their mistakes. But now that I've made the mistakes, I'm trying to come out and do better. But I still feel like I'm being held back. And he's holding a grudge against society because he feels like the white world won't allow him to succeed. And it's not till the friendship evolves with Bryan Cranston's character and my character that my eyes are open and some things that I thought I now realize aren't true. So what I love is that these two guys basically educate one another on their sides of the world. And they show each other that you can't judge a book by its cover and assume. It's better to assess and understand the situation fully. And that's what happens with these guys. They understand each other and they understand each other's background and situation, which allows them to develop this friendship and also look at each other and each other's struggles a little more different.
Your father was in prison for 4 years when you were, I think you were eight when he...
I was young.
Is eight right?
Between, roundabout. Mm-hmm. Around about that time. You're not far off.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever visit him in prison?
My dad? My dad went when I was younger. When I was really, really young, he went one time, and my mom took me to visit him then. When I was older and he went back, no, I didn't visit him that time. But I mean, at that point, he was in and out.
You know,
his longer stint, I was younger, my mom wanted to make sure he saw us. But then in the other times, it was like, that became a ritual. So my mom was kind of frustrated with it. So it was more, you know, I'll see him when he gets out.
So
it was just never brought up.
What kind of idea did that give you about how easy it was to be in and out of prison? Do you know what I mean? Like, because, like, your father was in and out, so did his team, like, prison was just, like, a possibility that could happen.
For me, I think when you really, really, really know that that's a reality and this can happen and become your life if you follow suit. And seeing my dad go through all of the turmoil that he went through basically put me in a position to just say, that's not for me. That's not the life that I want.
So I know you've said you don't want to talk about the Oscars anymore. It's the kind of elephant in the room, so I'll ask you a question about it, which I realize you might not answer, but I'm going to ask it.
Okay.
So no one is happy with how this worked out. The people in whatever Oscars committee it is that decides who the host is going to be, I'm sure they're not happy with how it worked out. They don't even have a host now. There's not going to be a host. And I'm sure you're not happy with how all of this has blown up. Like, what went wrong? Like, what was mishandled along the way? How did this happen?
Well, I mean, you know, I think things caught on fire very quickly. And everybody reacted instead of really assessing the situation properly. And, you know, in return, decisions were made on my part. And it's something that I felt that I should do. And I didn't want to sway and go back and forth with that decision. So I decided to stick with it. You know, there's no ill will or gripe between me and the Academy. We're fine. But it just didn't work out this year. You know, it wasn't in God's plan. That's how I look at it.
Okay. Is there anything you wish had been handled differently along the way?
I mean, you can go and say those things, but you know, it serves no purpose. You know, just talking about the hypothetical. What happened. More apologies were given after I stepped down. I made sure that it was very clear where I stood and that the LGBTQ community understood my position within my apology. And after doing that several times, I just kind of saw back and forth that I didn't know if it was being received or not. And I said, you know, it's just a game that I'm not going to keep playing, you know. Ultimately, I have 10 years of separation in between the time that was brought back up and now. And I think those 10 years acted as a great example of just change. And in order for people to evolve, you have to accept their change. That's how you get to the place of equality. I don't think that you can make everyone happy. And, you know, my apology was sincere when it was given. And I made it sincere when I gave it again. And my effort after that, when I gave another one, was just as sincere. But it just seemed as if it was a never-ending cycle. So I chose to just shut it down and say that I'm done with it and move on from it.
So I don't want to...
You're fine. You can ask the stuff. You're okay.
Great. Yeah. So I'm not going to run through, like, every tweet that was questioned or every joke that was questioned. But what I would like to talk about is how you evolved. I mean, you just said a couple of minutes ago that understanding how to grow and evolve is really important. And for me, as an interviewer, I always find it really interesting to hear how people became who they are, how they grew and evolved, and how they opened themselves up to new ideas and experiences. So in that spirit, I'd like to ask you some questions about how you evolved. And I'll say, like, I'm really, like you, I'm really glad people can change. That is a really positive thing. Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, what did it mean to be gay in your neighborhood?
Well, it wasn't something that was talked about or seen. You know, you have to understand, you're a product of your environment. Yeah, you've heard about it, and I know what the term means. I know what gay is. It doesn't mean that I'm around it and that I see it. So from my upbringing, it wasn't around. So the things that I was brought up on and the comedy that I watched and the way that my dad talked and my cousins talked and my brother talked, that's all I know. So you're a product of that. Now, because my life took me in a different direction, I traveled. I traveled the world. When you travel the world, you get to see things you never saw before. You get to see that other things exist, that other people exist. You get to be around all kinds of people. And when you go and you experience different things and different people, you become cultured. Your level of understanding and your knowledge grows to where now you are aware of things that you may not have been aware of before. Because of that, you're able to adapt and you're able to change and take bad habits away.
So judging from your memoir, your father had a very macho and very aggressive idea of what it meant to be a man. Mm-hmm. You write that, like, when you were shedding tears at your mother's funeral in 2006, your father punched you in the back of your head and told you
punched me in the back of my head
and told you to be a man and stop being a bitch. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did that affect your vision of manhood?
Didn't affect it at all. That's what I knew. That was my dad. All right, Dad. All right, I guess I'm bitching. Let me stop. So okay.
But you were brought up with this. You were already kind of formed in 2006 when your mother died. But when you were a child, your father gave you all kinds of signs of what it meant to be a man. You know, like throwing you into a pool or a lake when you couldn't swim, and telling you that he was disappointed in you because you weren't as deep into sports as he wanted you to be. Mm-hmm. Do you think he was ever afraid that you weren't going to be like manly?
I don't think that there was a fear. I think that my dad's vision and goal was for me to be a replica of him. He wanted to see me have some of his personality traits and characteristics. Like, you want to see that. As my mom, I'm quite sure my mom wanted to see certain things rub off on me that she could say, that's me. I put that in my child. That's just a parent.
So one of the things he told you in terms of wanting you to be like him, one of the things he told you was the pleasures of having sex when you're high on crack. I mean, this isn't the guy you wanted to become. So it must have been hard for you to be trained in how to be your father.
You have to make that decision yourself. You can start, as things unfold, you're smart enough now. You're becoming a young adult. You know, the version of me that now is at an age where I'm processing information and I'm seeing what's going on, I'm like, wait a minute. This may not be the right side for me.
I want to just get in a few words about your late mother. It sounds like she was a tough woman who became very, very religious. And I think your mother worked so hard to keep you, and you say this in the book, to keep you off the streets and out of trouble and to work hard. And you're known as, like, you have so many things going on professionally. You're obviously, mm-hmm. like, really hardworking. But she sounds like, in many ways, she was the opposite of your father. She didn't believe in fighting. She couldn't stand the smell of cigarettes, weed, or alcohol. She believed sex was a sacred thing. And she found every way to schedule your time. I mean, like spelling bees and a community swim team. You were on the basketball team. Were you grateful at the time that she made sure that every minute was scheduled when it could be to keep you off the streets and out of trouble? Did you resent that at the time? And in retrospect, are you grateful for it?
I think 100% that right now I am so thankful for the fact that my mother did so much for me with the time that I had. I'm so happy and so appreciative and thankful that she was willing to put the time in to make sure that I stayed constructive. You know, my mom never wanted there to be an idle hour of my day. She just wanted me to basically make use of my time and just always understand that those hours are valuable. You know, an idle mind is a wasted mind. So she just made sure that I was always busy. And I love that, because until this day, that's something that I've taken and that I've applied to my life.
So, you know, we've talked about your father and the influence he had on your life. In terms of you being a father, two of the most, like, famous things you've said about being a father are, you know, one's a tweet and one's in one of your comedy specials. And these are two of the things that have been under such discussion lately. In 2010, on your comedy special, Seriously Funny, you said, "As a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will. Every kid has a gay moment, but you have to stop it right there." And in 2012, you tweeted, "If my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say in my voice, stop, that's gay." So getting back to the first statement, that if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will. We've talked a little earlier about your image of what it meant to be gay and how you didn't know gay people from growing up. But this sounds like when you had a son, you were afraid that your son was going to be gay. So what did gay mean to you then? What is it you were afraid of?
Well, I think that that's taking a joke and putting a context that you're determining it should be on it. You know, the joke was made with light intentions. It's not that deep-rooted. But because of the time today, people look at it and they dissect it and they want it to be. The part that's always left out of that joke, which I think is so convenient for those that dig it up, is the joke starts off by saying, I don't have a homophobic bone in my body. I love gay people. If you want to be gay, be gay. I have no problem with gay people at all. That's how the joke starts off. And then I say, but as a heterosexual male, if I can prevent myself from being gay, I would. It's a joke. It's called a segue. The segue was to get into the joke about something that really happened at a party where my son was playing and there was another boy playing with him. And I was like, hey, all right, that's enough of that. It was a real moment. And that's where comedy comes from. It comes from real moments. But because times today are so sensitive, we forget that jokes are made with the intensive purpose of making people laugh, not to hurt. That's not the purpose behind a joke. So when you say, you know, is that a fear? No, it's not a fear. I don't care what my child decides to grow up and be. You're not a monster. You're gonna stop loving your kid? You're gonna stop being there for your child? Not me. What have I done to show that I'm that person? Nothing. It's just a moment in 2008 that I thought was funny.
It was 2010, I think.
The special, that special was done in 2008. It aired in 10.
Oh, I see, I see,
Seriously
I see.
Funny.
I see, okay.
That's material from 2008.
Okay.
That's when the special aired. So once again, you're looking at 10 plus years. Where after
I accept that you've evolved. I'm just thinking that I understand what you're saying, but jokes are funny because they're based on truth. And
they're based off of moments that you've had.
Right, but
that's what comedy is. That's where it comes from.
But saying that you're going to break the dollhouse over your son's head if you think he's gay, or that you have to stop it, you have to prevent your son from being gay. The reason why it's not funny to a lot of us is, you know, a lot of people, is that it's not like there's no truth in that. You can't, if someone's gay, you're not going to prevent them from doing it, from being gay. You can break a dollhouse over their head. It's just going to hurt, but it's not going to change their sexual orientation. And
here's what's being done. You're taking a moment that was done with the intensive purpose of trying to be funny. The bad part about being a comedian is that sometimes you just aren't funny. That tweet was done with the intensive purpose to try to make people laugh.
What was the joke?
It didn't work.
What was the funny part?
There is no funny part to you. To me, when I did it, I thought that it would be funny. So if people choose to take offense to something, then that's a choice. It's very easy to say, I didn't think that was funny, and then move on from the joke. That doesn't mean that it has to be a personal vendetta towards people. It's called trying to be funny. It's stupid. It's Twitter. I did a tweet years ago where I said, dark-skinned women got bad credit. Light-skinned women don't. Dark-skinned women went crazy. Black women went crazy. It was a stupid tweet where I tried to be funny. Doesn't mean that I hate dark-skinned women. My daughter is dark-skinned. My ex-wife was dark-skinned. It was me trying to make a joke. But people take these jokes, and they want them to be so much more. We've lost the thought that comedians try to be edgy and funny. It doesn't mean that you get it right all the time. It doesn't mean that there's a malicious piece to it. You're just trying to make people laugh.
Kevin Hart, I want to thank you so much for this interview. I've enjoyed getting to know you a little bit, and I feel like I already knew you a little bit from your work and from your memoir, which I should mention is called I Can't Make This Up. And I'm glad that you're getting new opportunities in movies. So thank you very much. I really appreciate this conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it as well. I know that there will be more. I'm looking forward to talking to you again.
My interview with Kevin Hart was recorded last Wednesday. He stars in the new movie, The Upside. You probably know my next guest, Ben Stiller, for his work acting in and directing film comedies, and lately for playing Michael Cohen on Saturday Night Live. But now he's getting praise for directing the 7-part Showtime drama series, Escape at Dannemora, which has earned him a nomination for a Directors Guild Award. Escape at Dannemora is based on the true story of two inmates who escaped from a maximum security prison in upstate New York in 2015. The series is not just about planning and executing the escape. It's also a character study of those two inmates and the woman who worked at the prison who helped them escape. Both inmates, Richard Matt, played by Benicio del Toro, and David Sweat, played by Paul Dano, worked at the prison tailor shop where prison uniforms were made. They convinced the civilian employee who ran the shop, Joyce Tilly Mitchell, to get them the tools they used to dig through the basement walls and steam pipes of the old prison to escape. They were able to manipulate her through sexual relationships with her. They told her they wanted to be with her after they escaped. What they really wanted was for her to be with them just long enough to get the getaway car and get them to a safe place. She's played by Patricia Arquette, who just won a Golden Globe for her performance. The series opens with Arquette's character, Tilly Mitchell, in jail, this time as an inmate, not an employee. She's being questioned by the New York State Inspector General, who's investigating the escape. The Inspector General is played by Bonnie Hunt.
Nice to meet you, Joyce.
Everybody calls me Tilly.
Tilly it is.
Joyce is my mother's name. When you call me Joyce, I feel like you're talking to my mother.
Is your mom still with us? Oh, good. I love knowing my mom's just a phone call away.
I already talked to the cops.
4 times in 7 days, I understand.
Yeah, so what is this?
Let's not get into any details until the stenographer gets here. I mean, even though it's all taped, it's actually more accurate. This girl especially, she's been with me 15 years. I did a comparison. And I was right.
Are you with the state police?
Please, no, I'm the Inspector General for the state of New York.
Oh, so the post office?
No, the post office is federal. I'm state. So if there's any corruption in a state agency, it's my job to find it and stop it. Whether it's a state park or the Port Authority, and I report directly to the governor.
Am I gonna lose my job?
Should you?
Ben Stiller, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on Escape at Dannemora. Were there aspects of this story that most interested you?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was the actual escape part, and I really was into that. And as I learned more about it and read more about the prison itself, what really interested me was how they were able to do this, how they were able to get away with this in 2015. It seemed like such an old-fashioned sort of escape. And I thought, wow, how can that happen in today's prison system? Which, you know, when you think about the prison system in the United States, you think of it as being sort of, it seems sort of depressing, obviously, but and you think of these institutions, they don't seem like they're state of the art, but to actually have people be able to do something like that was fascinating to me, that they could get away with it in this day and age. And so that part of it, and then the relationships that developed in the prison that allowed them to be able to get the tools, which led to Tilly and the fact that she was actually having this interaction and relationship with these two guys, which then led to the tailor shop and what exists in that place and how that works, which was really, really interesting and something I had no idea existed.
You're talking about the prison tailor shop where both of the inmates and the woman who helped them escape work, and they make prison uniforms there. So what was so surprising to you about that?
Just the fact that it was so, I don't want to say loose, but open in terms of the way the actual physical setup of it, which was 40 or so inmates who are in a maximum security facility for, you know, committing violent crimes in a room with one civilian supervisor and one corrections officer, and that's it. And these men are, you know, working with scissors and shears and, you know, all sorts of instruments that could be, you know, used for bad things. And it's just sort of like an honor system that's going on in there. And how low tech it was.
Mm-hmm.
Really low tech, you know, really no video cameras. There's that back room that they would go into, that Tilly would go into.
Where she had covert sexual relations with the inmates.
Yes, yes. And just how the whole thing was sort of kind of like operated. It's, first of all, it's a business. Corecraft is a for-profit business. That's so, you know, the civilian supervisor is overseeing these inmates who are working for something like 35 or 40 cents an hour. And they have to meet a quota, and it's kind of like a strange situation, you know? It's just, it's because, you know, when you think about that, these, you know, the civilian supervisor has to fill quotas, and these workers have to be motivated to do that when they're prisoners who are working for basically, you know, hardly anything. It's just, it's kind of a screwed up dynamic, I think.
You were able to actually shoot at Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, where the story is set. Did you have any protection when you were shooting in there? Did you feel like you needed any? Did the correctional facility feel like you needed any?
The first trip that we took in there, we got ushered into a little trailer that, like, sort of a permanent trailer they had set up, and a meeting room in there, and the superintendent and the deputy superintendent and a bunch of people who were administrators at the prison gave us a talk and told us what we were going to be doing and the tour we were going to be taking, and, you know, basically said this is a dangerous environment, and they were going to do everything they could to keep us safe and keep things as low-key as possible, but the reality is, you know, you're in a prison, and so you don't know what could happen. And they tried to walk us through spaces at times when prisoners weren't there in the spaces. So, like, we were actually ushered into the sort of this small little office area when you first walk in, where the corrections officers can lock themselves in to, you know, turn on lights and things like that. And because the timing was off, there were probably about 12 of us from the crew. We all kind of jammed into that little office while they let the inmates go out for lunch because they were behind schedule. And that was a really strange experience because, you know, we were all jammed into this little office, and then, you know, the inmates were looking at us, we were looking at them, and, you know, they're human beings, they're people, but, you know, I'm sure they had their thoughts about what are these visitors up to? And then you just see that, you know, the reality of life for these people, which is very, you know, it's regimented, and it's, and obviously they're all there for a reason, but, as you know, in terms of, like, the human condition of it, it's pretty heavy.
So one of the things that you depict in the film, which was in news stories, you know, about the escape and also in the Inspector General's report, is how sex was traded for favors, and how the two inmates and the woman who Patricia Arquette plays, who was assigned to supervise, you know, the civilian employee assigned to supervise the tailor shop where the two inmates worked. The two inmates who escaped were manipulating her. She was manipulating them. It was a kind of complicated game that they were playing. But because of the sex for favors thing, she ended up smuggling, you know, helping to smuggle into them the tools that they needed to escape. But, you know, you also depict the sex some of the sex that they had. And you had to decide, like, how are you going to depict that? It's a key part of the story. It's a key part for, like, the motivation. It's a key part for how the inmates got the tools they needed. The Inspector General's report makes it clear that the Inspector General concluded that the character that Benicio del Toro played, Richard Matt, did have sex with Joyce Tilly Mitchell. But David Sweat, the inmate who survived the escape and is back in prison, it's unclear whether he definitely had sex with her or whether it's just people saying that he did, because he denied it and Tilly denied it too.
That's correct.
So yeah. You had to decide should you depict that or not. But so let's start with there. Decide, because it's definitive in your version of the story that they actually did have sex, and that even when he wanted to stop, she kind of wouldn't let him.
Yeah, I mean, we decided to make that choice because of the evidence that we saw in reading the reports and reading the interviews and the transcripts, and even for me talking to David Sweat, who still denied it when I talked to him. And look, I'm not saying that it definitely happened, but in our estimation from looking at the evidence of how many notes were passed between him and her, how he was kicked out of the tailor shop for going in the back room with her, how she was taking pictures of herself, naked pictures of herself in her private parts and giving it to him. And he gave her his undershirt as we depict in the show. And also we really felt that there was a relationship going on there that was going beyond the bounds of what they both say was happening. Now we could be wrong, and I know that Joyce Mitchell spoke out about it, and I was clear in saying this isn't a documentary, but I wouldn't have put that in there if I didn't feel that that was closer to the truth than what they were saying. But that is our stipulation.
Yeah, she called you a liar and an idiot.
I think a son of a bitch, idiot, and a liar, and yeah.
and accused you of exploiting her story for millions of dollars.
Yeah, which is that's not happening, at least in terms of the monetary aspect. That wasn't my motivation. That's not what's happening. I was fascinated by the story, and she's, she has stuck to that story the whole time, but it's, it's also clear that she was not truthful when you look at her her multiple interviews with the state police and then with the inspector general, and how many times she contradicted herself and changed her story. So, mm-hmm. I said I don't have any ill will towards her, and I can understand that it's probably not a great experience that she's having right now.
You chose not to try to meet with her, is that right?
Yeah.
You did meet with David Sweat, the survivor of the two inmates. He's the one who's played by Paul Dano. Why did you want to meet with him, and what was that meeting like?
Well, it was really interesting. I wanted to meet with him mainly because I'd spent so much time on the research, and I wrote a letter to him, and then the Department of Corrections, when they decided to start helping us, offered us access to go meet with him, and he agreed to meet. So I just wanted to, sit across from him and see what he had to say about the escape, especially. I mean, the details of the escape were really the most interesting thing to me about talking to him, and why I wanted to talk to him.
Was he really proud of what he accomplished by figuring out how to escape from a maximum security prison?
I think he had a... My experience with him was that he was very affable, and he had a sense of not really wanting to boast about it in a way that seemed like he had accomplished something that was good. I think he really made it clear that he knew that he had done something wrong and didn't want to seem that he was kind of proud of it. At the same time, he offered up all the details that I, could ask for, and was really, specific. And I think, I think he does feel like he did something, but he never once boasted about it in a way that he thought it was something good that he had done. I don't think he was trying to sort of, bask in that.
Something I kept wondering, watching Escape at Dannemora, like, didn't these guys ever watch a Prison Break movie? Like, no one, it never works out. Like, even if you escape, like, you're shot or you're brought back to prison, it never works. Like, did you think about that?
Well, no, I mean, I didn't think I would. Here's what I mean, for me, going into that prison and spending a very little amount of time in that prison, the first thing I thought about was getting out. That was, you know, I was so happy to leave. At, you know, after I, while it was fascinating, or even when we were shooting at the end of the day, I was, you know, I felt so fortunate to leave. So it doesn't shock me that anybody in there would want to get out, even if, you know, you knew that it was, the odds were against you. I mean, I think you have to have a certain type of personality to actually say, I'm going to go for this, because the, you know, the flip side is if you get caught, it, you know, you're in worse shape. But these guys were aware of Shawshank Redemption. They actually even made a joke when they got to the outer wall where Sweat saw the wall, and he said, you know, this is like Shawshank Redemption. It's going to take us, it took them 20 years. And like Matt said something, it's going to take us 10 or something. And we actually had that dialogue in the show, and I took it out because it just seemed too self-referential. But that actually, but Sweat says that interaction happened. So I think they definitely knew about, you know, I mean, they knew, you know, movies and pop culture and all that, but I think they, you know, just had a desire to really get out of that place. And they did, you know, the other thing is that Sweat did do this dry run the night before when he finally cut through the pipe on the other side of the wall and got out, and he got to the manhole cover at about 3:30 or something in the morning on, I guess it was Friday night before, or Thursday night before, because they left on a Friday night. But he could have left without Matt, and he didn't. And when I asked him, he said that, well, they just had this plan because Tilly was going to meet them. But he said if he hadn't have waited, if he had left, he could have just stolen a motorcycle, and he probably would have gotten very far, and he could easily have gotten to Canada in the middle of the night and gone through, and it would have been much tougher to find him.
So Benicio del Toro plays the convicted murderer and prison escapee as both charming when he wants to be and just really terrifying and crazy at other times, threatening, out of control. Did you give him any suggestions or any insights into what you wanted him to bring out?
Yes, because I'm going to tell Benicio del Toro how to be intimidating and scary. I really felt like he hadn't achieved that, and I could help him out with that. you know, I loved working with him. He had so many specific ideas about how to approach this character and make, you know, make him a full character that was obviously very, very manipulative and able to intimidate and operate in that world. And so I relied on his instincts a lot of the time that I would then kind of go back and forth with him on. And in certain scenes, I would have more of an instinct of what I felt should happen. But he always had a very, very strong point of view. I mean, one of the things that he suggested that I thought worked really well was in the first episode, we originally had him doing something violent to somebody on the North Yard to show that he was a dangerous guy. Because violence happens out on the North Yard. People get shivved, you know, people get beaten up. Things happen out there. And he suggested that we cut that scene and not show Matt being violent until the sixth episode when we see the flashback. And I thought that was a really bold choice on his part, because what he was basically saying is I can be intimidating and scary without having to show any violence. And I think our show is probably like the least violent prison show ever made, you know? I mean, it's really, except maybe for Stir Crazy or something, you know? I mean, it's not, there are no scenes of, you know, you don't see any, except for, you know, obviously
not
the
not
graphics.
In prison, but outside of prison.
Well, in that one episode.
Yeah, in that one episode.
But
yeah.
That one episode, but yeah. Other than that one episode, there really isn't anything else. And so that was his choice, you know? He said, I think this will be much more effective to see the violence of this guy, you know, that deep into the story.
So Patricia Arquette gained around 40 pounds to play the prison employee. And what issues does that create for you as a director? Because there was also, you know, the scenes that are shot when she's in prison or jail. And so her weight changes depending on what the time is that you're right. Shooting. So it takes time to gain weight and it takes time to lose weight. So just as the director in that situation, as opposed to being the person who has to eat a lot or stop eating, what are the issues that you have to deal with?
Well, I was concerned about it, first of all, because the shoot was so long. The shoot was 8 months long, and I really felt like she needed to gain the weight to, you know, you can't just wear a sort of, you know, a suit to make you look heavier. It changes her face and all that. And she was also wearing teeth and contact lenses to make her eyes brown because she has these piercing blue eyes. And so it was a whole bunch of things. But the weight was really, really important, I felt, because she has such, she's a very classically beautiful woman who has these movie star looks, and she was trying to sort of get away from that for this character, and it was tough because I kept on encouraging her to to eat. So and Paul Dano was working out with a weight coach because he's not as built as David Sweat was, because David Sweat built up in prison because he was afraid of getting beaten up. So all of them had to commit to changing their bodies.
So we have to talk about playing Michael Cohen on Saturday Night Live. So let's start with a clip. And so this is from December 1st. And President Trump is feeling lonely at the G20 summit in Argentina. So he calls Michael Cohen. And while on the phone, of course, he wants advice about how to handle the Mueller probe. So here's Alec Baldwin as Trump and my guest Ben Stiller as Michael Cohen.
All alone again. No one understands me. Who can I call? Someone who I know will always answer.
Yes, hello? Hello? Michael Cohen speaking. I'll tell you anything you want.
Michael, it's Donald.
No, Mr. Trump, I'm not supposed to be talking to you.
Come on, Michael.
No, I'm going to get in trouble.
But Mikey Coco, I need a bowl of my Mikey Coco Puffs.
Okay, fine. I can't say no to my Donnie Trumpalophagus.
Yes, Michael. You got to get me out of this. Who can I give up to the feds? What if I put my son Eric in some old age makeup in a fat suit and say it's me?
I'm not sure that'll work, sir.
Trust me, Eric will never catch on.
I'm sorry, Mr. Trump. It's over.
Well, Michael, at least there are some things they can never take away from us. Our late night talks.
They got him on tape.
Our vacations to Moscow.
They seized the records.
What about our hairstylist, the blind man with the shaky hands?
He died like months ago.
I'm sad you're going to prison, Michael. You were like a son to me.
Then why'd you make me do so much illegal stuff?
It's because you were like a son to me. Goodbye, Michael.
It's Alec Baldwin and my guest Ben Stiller on Saturday Night Live. How did you become Michael Cohen on SNL?
I got a call from, an email from Lauren Michaels. I actually was emailing Lauren to tell him that I wanted to bring my daughter to the show for the first time, who's 16. And it was the week, I guess, that this came up, and he sent me back an email and said, oh, that's great. Yeah, definitely. You can bring her. And oh, by the way, do you have a Michael Cohen lying around? Meaning, do I have a Michael Cohen impression lying around? Which I, of course, didn't. And that was it. And then I tried to YouTubed him and tried to come up with some version, because he didn't really talk that much. You didn't hear him talk that much. And that was it. And, you know, that's the way it works on SNL. They'll write the piece, you know, maybe on Thursday if you're lucky, but usually on Friday, or even being rewritten on Saturday up till the show. So sometimes I would get the call like on Friday night, but that's how that happened the first time.
And you're in New York, so are you in New York?
Yes, I'm a New Yorker, and it was pretty convenient. And also, I was in the sort of like in the midst of editing Dannemora, so it was a pretty funny experience to kind of jump into basically like the opposite experience of editing. Editing is, you know, where you're sitting in a room with an editor and just kind of, you know, and not in any mode other than sort of watching and looking, and then all of a sudden you're like being thrown into live performing in front of a national audience, which is not my favorite thing to do.
Must be so much fun for you the first time you walk on stage as Michael Cohen and hear the audience's response. Like, the audience goes crazy.
I mean, there's nothing like being on Saturday Night Live and the craziness of it. I mean, it's really, you know, there's nothing like that feeling of, I don't know, that feeling in the pit of your stomach. And it's just, you know, it's an iconic show and it's live. And I was actually just talking to one of the cast members last night about how that's a gene that certain performers have, which I don't. I don't enjoy that. I don't sort of, you know, live for that. I'm much happier doing multiple takes, if, you know, making a movie or, you know, not having a few shots at it. But there's certain performers who are so brilliant at it, at doing that live. I think a lot of the cast members that are on now. But so, yeah, there's nothing like that feeling. I find it incredibly exciting / stressful. And then it's really fun. I mean, it's really, really fun when, you know, when something works and you're in that, you know, it's like a one of a kind sort of experience.
Well, Ben Stiller, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Terry, thank you.
Ben Stiller directed the 7-part Showtime series Escape at Dannemora, which is available on demand. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zadie, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.